Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what did Jewish American soldiers do in displaced persons camps after World War II? The National Museum of American Jewish Military History is located in Washington, D.C. Under the auspices of the Jewish War Veterans of the USA, it documents and preserves the contributions of Jewish Americans to the peace and freedom of the United States, educates the public concerning the courage, heroism, and sacrifices made by Jewish Americans who served in the armed forces, and works to combat anti-Semitism. The museum houses both permanent and temporary exhibitions, and over the years has also hosted many public programs, such as lectures, book talks, and webinars. Michael Rugel, the museum's director of programs and content, has worked to expand their event and program offerings, utilizing Zoom and YouTube to reach a wider audience. We spoke with him about the history of Jews in the American military and the museum.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Michael.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
First, could you tell us briefly a little bit about American Jewish military history? Because I think most people know that the first Jews who settled in what became the United States was Sephardic, and they arrived in the 17th century. And then waves of Ashkenazi Jews arrived from Germany and Eastern Europe in the 19th century. But I don't think we really associate Jews with the American military. So could you give us a brief summary of their military history from the beginning until today?
We start our stories with the New Amsterdam colony that arrives in 1654. And amongst the Jews in New Amsterdam was a guy named Asser Levy, who was told in New Amsterdam that it was the responsibility of every citizen to serve as a defender of the colony. But Levy was specifically told, as a Jew, he's not allowed, and he actually had to pay a special tax to have somebody else do it in his place. So when Levy appeals that ruling and does get to serve as a guard and defender of the colony, he becomes the first Jew to serve in not the military per se, but that kind of role in what's to become the United States. In the Revolutionary War, the tiny percentage of the population is Jewish, but there's several important military officers and a lot of important soldiers serving in the Continental Army. And then by the time we get to the Civil War, prior to the Civil War, there is a wave of Jewish immigration from Germany and from Central Europe. So there's a generation of young, newly arrived American Jews from Europe that end up serving in the American Civil War, and they fight on both sides, North and South, more in the North than the South at this point, but they are fighting on both sides, Jewish brother against brother, and there's several Jewish officers that had fought in the 1848 revolutions in Europe, trying to overthrow monarchies, and had, in search of democracy, had come to the United States and end up fighting in the Civil War. So there's a lot of fascinating stories there on both sides.
And then?
Yeah, Jews continue to serve in the Spanish-American War in 1898. And when we get to World War I, that's the first time we're talking about really big numbers. And the estimates that are about 250,000 American Jews serve in the First World War. And by then, we've gotten the big wave of Jewish immigration to the United States that had come from the Russian Empire. A lot of the Jews had specifically left Russia to avoid military service. And one of the main themes we see in World War I is these Jews who left Russia to try to get out of the army, either here, volunteer, or at least register for the draft without complaint, and a much different attitude towards military service here in the U.S. than there was in Russia. So with over 200,000 Jews in service, there's a lot of developments. An organization called the Jewish Welfare Board is created as the morale organization for soldiers and sailors in the U.S. military. Prior to that, the YMCA had been the morale organization for everyone, which is the Young Men's Christian Association. So now that there's over 200,000 Jews in service, it becomes clear that having the Young Men's Christian Association be the morale organization for everyone isn't working anymore. And the Jewish Welfare Board is created, and that's the organization that can approve who's a Jewish chaplain that can serve in the military. They recommend rabbis to become military chaplains. They build little tents and huts on forts that pop up across the country as the military effort builds up a huge new military structure across the United States. This Jewish Welfare Board is a part of all of that, and then their volunteers end up serving in Europe during the First World War and helping American Jews serve. And by this point, Jewish officers, Jewish enlisted, they're doing anything and everything you can think of in the military. And then finally, we arrive at World War II. And of course, that's bigger than anything else in terms of most of the world, but it impacts every aspect of American life. And over 500,000 American Jews serve in the Second World War. And that's when we get these remarkable stories about Jews that had escaped Nazi Europe and come here and return as American soldiers. You get these great stories of American Jewish soldiers that end up liberating concentration camps and interacting with the Holocaust survivors in those camps, as well as American Jews serving in the Pacific on the home front, doing anything and everything you can think of.
And then there was Vietnam.
Yeah, so Jews continue to serve through Vietnam. The numbers get a little tougher after World War I and World War II. There were these Bureau of Jewish War Records that really made an effort to account for how many Jews served in the military, and they sent out questionnaires to families saying, "Can you confirm that your son or daughter was Jewish? Can you confirm what they did in the war?" And there were these really huge statistical efforts to document how many Jews served in World War I and World War II. By the time we get to Vietnam, I think this reflects that American Jews are a little more comfortable with their place in society. So American Jews serve like all Americans in Vietnam, and kind of the classic Vietnam stories of dealing with a unpopular war. And one of the interesting things that I see it as is the varied response of American soldiers to their experiences in Vietnam. And you see some dedicating their lives and becoming career military guys, and you see others respond with a dedication to social justice and trying to ensure that the Tu Quyen Lam concept is spread throughout the world. And the Vietnam was a huge motivator in how the veterans live the rest of their lives, no matter what route they chose. The experience of war certainly changed and affected all aspects of their future lives.
The United States doesn't have a draft anymore. So, what about in peacetime? Are there many Jews who belong to the military?
So there continue to be Jews in the military, and as American demographics have kind of gotten, the Jewish population now skews old and skews more urban, and the military population is the opposite, young and mostly from southern states or rural areas. It's tough to get a hold of good numbers. It's definitely a different situation now than in World War II, but Jews continue to serve in all aspects of the military. Officers, enlisted men, doing all kinds of jobs. The numbers are sometimes tough to come by, and you see some estimates that the 10 to 15,000 Jews in the current military, but they are pretty rough estimates. But Jews continue to serve as they always have in peacetime as well as in wartime. And for the more recent conflicts here at the museum, we have a display identifying the identified American Jews killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we've identified 58 Jewish Americans who were killed in either Iraq or Afghanistan.
Okay, so let's talk about the museum. I'd like to talk about the history of it and how it evolved. Before the actual museum was created, there was a national shrine to the Jewish war dead. Can you tell us a little bit about who was behind it and describe it and when and where it was built?
Sure. So the origins of the museum start with the Jewish War Veterans of the USA, the Organization for Jewish Veterans, and JWV traced their roots back to 1896. And in 1896, a group of Civil War vets, Union vets, form an organization called the Hebrew Union Veterans Association in New York. And that was designed, at least in part, designed as a response to the idea that gets repeated a lot in the 1890s that Jews didn't fight in the Civil War. There's a couple high-profile examples and publications. A Union officer wrote in my 4 years on the battlefield, I never saw a Jewish person. There's a famous example from Mark Twain. A little bit later, Twain wrote an essay called Concerning the Jews, and he writes, the Jew has a unpatriotic disinclination to stand by the flag on the battlefield. And he later rescinds that. He writes a postscript to that essay saying he's been informed of the correct war record of the Jews, and in fact, Jews have frequently served in higher percentages than their Christian counterparts. So in 1896, these guys kind of got tired of hearing that idea that Jews didn't fight in the Civil War. They formed this Veterans Association to show that they were there just like all other Americans, and that's kind of what we're still doing today. But in the 50s, the Jewish war veterans initially want to create a memorial, and they start that in the mid-50s. And in 1958, they get a congressional charter to create a museum and memorial. And initially, it's a pure memorial called Shrine to the Jewish War Dead, where they memorialize Jewish dead. And this is another thing that the initial Civil War vets wanted to do, was memorialize Jews killed in war efforts in a specifically Jewish way. A lot of the memorial services were in church and took the more standard Christian way of memorializing them. So they wanted to be able to acknowledge them as Jews and memorialize them as Jews. So the museum is initially created in the 50s as that shrine to the Jewish war dead.
Mm-hmm. What did Congress have to do with this?
There's an act of Congress in 1958 creating a charter for a memorial and museum. And they so there's national organizations chartered by the U.S. Congress. And the Veterans Organization got Congress to charter a museum, which doesn't come with any funding or any of the benefits, but it does come with a as an act of Congress. And we have the legislation hanging on the wall here creating this museum and memorial.
But was an act of Congress necessary, or could it have been done without an act of Congress?
Yes, it certainly could have created it without an act of Congress.
Oh,
but,
okay.
You know, we have the National Museum of American Jewish Military, and, you know, we hang our heads. The national part of that, some of that comes from the congressional charter. But it would not have been necessary. Yeah, they could have done it without plenty of museums. Most museums exist without congressional charters.
So how did this evolve to become the museum?
Yeah, so in the late 70s, they start doing a little more collecting of archival materials and artifacts from military history, and they determine that they want to go beyond just memorializing and be able to discuss the history, interpret the history, and create history exhibits. So in the early 80s, they purchased the building here in Washington, D.C., and it opens up as a museum in 1984.
What did it contain at the beginning? How, you know, what was it like at first, and how has it evolved since then?
Yeah, so at the beginning, they still had the memorialization as a key factor. They did some early exhibits that did some things like compare World War I veterans and Vietnam veterans. They had some photography displays in the early years. By the time we get to the 90s is really when they're kind of doing bigger history exhibits, and they did some great exhibits in the 90s that I still frequently call upon the materials, and those includes GIs Remember, which was about the American Jewish soldiers that are liberators of concentration camps. They did a Jewish women in the military exhibit right around the turn of the millennium that we are now kind of making an effort to update and do a current version of that. We put in the first kind of comprehensive exhibit that chronologically comprehensive that goes from that 1654 New Amsterdam colony up through Iraq and Afghanistan in a little over 10 years ago. And that's still our core exhibit. Well, the women in the military, we have a preliminary version of that up in the museum now. But the most recent full exhibit is a Vietnam exhibit that was actually curated by the Vietnam Veterans Committee of Jewish War Veterans of the USA.
So those two are temporary exhibits, the women and the Vietnam?
They do not have an end date at this point. They're going to be up for a long time. Let's put it that way.
Can you tell us about any other temporary exhibits that you've had?
Yeah, so it was an exhibit called Rescue and Renewal that kind of expanded upon the role of the Jewish liberators of concentration camps and got into the role of American Jewish soldiers in the displaced person camps after the war, and they played some really important roles in that. American Jewish soldiers were helping Holocaust survivors to find family in the U.S. And you would hear these stories of Jewish soldiers calling into the Yiddish language radio stations in New York with the names of the displaced persons in these camps and trying to connect them with families. And the Jewish chaplains that are serving, the rabbis in the army mostly, kind of become civilian rabbis. And there are these stories of them conducting marriages, bar mitzvahs, kind of really acting as rabbis for the survivors, as well as their what is the core of their job as rabbis for the American military. So that was an important one that we did. For the most recent exhibit that came down was we called it A Mother's Grief, and it was about a young man named Sanford Kahn, who was from Kearny, New Jersey, who was killed in World War II, killed in Normandy about a month after D-Day. And the point of that was just to kind of get a one individual story, what it's like for a family to lose a son, and just show one person's perspective and how war and their desire to do their duty and give the ultimate sacrifice can impact everyone around them.
Tell us a little bit more about the permanent exhibition. What kinds of things does it contain? What sort of artifacts or photographs, or what does it have?
Yeah, so the oldest artifact in there is a Revolutionary War era rifle, which actually we don't have provenance back to a Jewish soldier for that, but it is just kind of a representative sample from the Revolution. That we have a Civil War era surgeon's kit in there, a kit that belonged to a surgeon named Charles Stein, and you can see the saws he used to cut into skull and bones with that. With that piece of equipment, gives you a little taste of Civil War medicine and what Dr. Stein must have been working with when he was in the medical tents right outside the battlefields in the Civil War. We have some papers of Russian immigrants getting American citizenship while serving as soldiers in World War I. When we get to World War II, there's some great artifacts. There's an ark that belonged to a Jewish chaplain named Morris Gordon. And the story behind Chaplain Gordon's arc is that Rabbi Gordon was serving in the China-Burma-India theater. And he's traveling in a Jeep that gets hit by a bomb and instantly kills the driver of the vehicle. And it throws Rabbi Gordon into a river alongside the road that they were on. And luckily for Rabbi Gordon, nearby is a Chinese officer. He sees Rabbi Gordon drowning in the river. He rushes over, pulls Rabbi Gordon out of the river, saves his life, but everything that Rabbi Gordon used for Jewish services in the field was destroyed in that explosion. So while Rabbi Gordon's recovering from his wounds, that Chinese officer that saved his life was able to get some teak wood, he gets some instructions, and he builds Rabbi Gordon an ark to carry a Torah in, which Rabbi Gordon's able to get a Torah, carry it in this ark, conduct Jewish services along the Burma Road throughout the China-Burma-India Theater for the rest of the war, and then becomes a prized possession in his home. After he passed away, his wife donated it to the museum, and it's here in our exhibits now.
That's a great story.
Yeah. So there's some artifacts that really tell great stories throughout the museum.
Tell us something about the visitors. How many do you get, and do you know anything about them, their ages or whatever?
We get about 2,500 visitors a year, somewhere along those lines. We collect some data where they're from. It's more D.C. area than anything else, but we do get visitors from around the country and around the world. We don't ask these questions, but my observation is that they are mostly from within the Jewish community. We do get some visits from veterans groups, from school groups. We occasionally do reach outside the Jewish community, but most of our visitors are Jewish, and they're people that are interested in American history and American Jewish history.
So you do get school groups?
Yeah. I wish we got more, but we do have regular school groups coming in from some Jewish schools across the country, from religious schools here in the D.C. area. And then we'll have occasional groups, usually on some type of programs that come from some of the local schools. But it would be nice to have more coming from outside the Jewish community so they can get a sense of the Jewish contributions to the United States. And we have some of that. It'd be nice to have more.
Do you get feedback from them?
Yeah. With school groups, there's typically a couple very interested kids in groups, and then the ones that would much prefer to be looking at their phones, and that's kind of the challenge. Ones that are really interested, and there always are some, in every group that have a lot of questions that want to know more about these wartime experiences.
Do you give tours? If I mean, I'm sure you do to school groups, but I mean, if let's say a few people wanted to go and visit the museum, do you arrange for tours, or is it
Yeah,
just?
so if you call ahead, we will either get a docent to give a tour, or I can do it myself. But yeah, there's a chance if you stop by and ask for it, you might be able to get a tour. But if you just walk into the street, you're usually going to be self-guided. But if you call in ahead and schedule something, we can get you a guided tour.
How are you funded?
The funding just comes from our membership, from private donors. There's been occasional grants from organizations or through the local governments, but mostly it's just from our membership. A lot of the money comes from members of the Jewish War Veterans Organization, but funding is a real challenge, and so we'll continue to try to reach outside that core group for more funding soon and continue to apply for grants. But most of our funding just comes from private donations from our members, from people that want to support our mission.
Have you been affected at all by these policies of the Trump government, like the Smithsonian Institution has, any of this kind of DEI stuff that?
Indirectly, so we're not getting hit like some of these places are. We would always hear from groups within government organizations looking for ideas about programs they could do for Jewish American Heritage Month, or they wanted to visit the museum. And those were all run by DEI offices that no longer exist. So that part has vanished this year. There's a couple things that we've done with partners, other museums, other places that are connected to the government that can't really use some of the things we produce because we emphasize a ethnic identity. So we are hitting some challenges, not compared to either the organizations actually are within the government or those that really rely on funding from the federal government, but we are getting some affected by it peripherally.
Do you have any plans for the future?
Yeah, so we want to continue to expand the Women in the Military exhibit I mentioned. So right now it's called Pearls of Valor, and it explores the roles of Jewish women in the military going back to the revolution. They go back that far. They're not in the military stories, but they're ways that Jewish women contributed to the war effort. It's really when we get to World War I that there's actually Jewish women and women in general in the military. But right now it's a panel display that's up on the wall. We want to enhance that, get more artifacts, more interpretation, more interactive technology in that exhibit. So that's kind of the next plan for enhancing the exhibits in the museum. We'll continue to have regular speakers and programs at the museum. We have some film screenings that we're planning coming up. There'll be some authored speaking coming up. And we also are, I believe, getting started on a fundraising campaign to kind of really look at the future and figure out what we're going to look like in the near term and hopefully in the long term.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we might have left out?
Let me share one. Yeah, you mentioned we skipped the Korean War story. Let me share like the one story I tell people. If you want to visit the museum, this is the one story to remember. It's of a guy named Tibor Rubin. He was born in Hungary, and is in concentration camps as a kid, as a young teenager, and he's in the Mauthausen concentration camp when it's liberated by American soldiers in 1945. So Tibor Rubin decides at that point he wants to be like these men, these American soldiers who liberated the concentration camp, and he decides he wants to come to the U.S. and join the army, which he does. And in 1950, he's serving in the Korean War. And he unfortunately has some of the worst stories of anti-Semitism in the U.S. Army of anyone. And Reuben is kind of picked on pretty mercilessly by the staff sergeant, who's his direct superior. And when I say he was picked on, that could mean the guy who has to clean up after everyone else, or it could mean actually in combat. And there's one particular story where his company is engaged in combat with North Koreans, and they decide to retreat. But they say, well, Tibor Rubin is ordered to stay behind, hold the road with a weapon stash so the rest of the guys can retreat safely. And he's left by himself for 24 straight hours, during which there's waves of North Korean soldiers attacking him. So he's by himself for 24 straight hours fighting a single-handed battle. There's a good book about him by Dan Cohen that's called Single-Handed. He survives this amazing 24-hour military action, eventually is captured and ends up in a prisoner of war camp that's run by the Chinese. Horrible conditions in this camp, but Tibor Rubin becomes known as the guy who helps out all the other guys in this prisoner of war camp. So they're not giving them nutrition, but there is a vegetable garden that the Chinese use for their own officers. So Rubin's the guy who steals vegetables and brings them back for the other guy. They're not getting any medical treatment, but Rubin's kind of learned these guerrilla medical techniques, and there's stories of him doing things like gathering maggots to eat away the dead flesh on these guys who have gangrenous wounds that are going untreated. And everyone's like, Rubin, what are you doing? But he saves these guys' lives with these kind of guerrilla medical techniques. And more than anything else, he's known as the guy who keeps up everyone's morale within this POW camp. And they say, you know, within these prisoner of war camps, once you've kind of quit, you're as good as dead. But Tibor Rubin's the guy who's helping everybody out and really helps people stay alive. He's credited with saving dozens of lives within this POW camp. The Chinese offer him the opportunity to return to Hungary, a communist country by this point. But he says, I'm an American soldier. I'm going to stay here, stay in these horrible conditions in this POW camp. He's eventually freed near the end of the war. But he's at first not recognized in any way, not given any kind of awards or recognition or medals, because it would have been that same staff sergeant recommending him for any kind of awards. And he just wasn't going to let this Hungarian Jew, who he didn't like at all, receive any kind of recognition. But over 50 years later, there's so much testimony about all the things that Tibor Rubin does. In 2005, he was awarded the Medal of Honor, the highest medal that you can receive as a member of the U.S. military. So just this extraordinary journey from Holocaust survivor to Medal of Honor recipient. So that's, you know, the one story I want people to take home from the museum, if you only leave with one.
That's an amazing story. And I'm wondering if surviving a concentration camp might have helped him.
I absolutely think that the skills, the experiences in Europe in the concentration camp helped him to be a skilled prisoner and prepared for the POW camp.
And I assume he was still alive when he received the medal.
He was. He died in 2015, so he got 10 years of recognition with the Medal of Honor.
I imagine that nothing happened to the staff sergeant.
Yeah, you know, Rubin would say he didn't want to put his name out there, so he would tell these stories without naming the staff sergeant. There's a couple good oral histories he's given, and you can hear Tibor Rubin talk about himself. Super modest guy. You know, people would say, you're a Superman, you're a super Jew. And he would say, no, I'm just a little schmuck. And he would always, the other great thing for our content is people asking, you know, why would he do these things to endanger himself to help others? And he would phrase it in terms of his Judaism. He would say, these are mitzvot. It's a commandment to me as a Jew to do these things. So it's just a really important story for us.
Do you have those oral histories available on your website?
So they're not on our website, but I can point you towards them. There's one from the Library of Congress. They have a veterans history program, so there's a long oral history on there. That's the one I usually refer to. I'll send you a link to that.
Okay, great. I'll put it on the program.
Yeah, good.
Okay,
good.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to do this.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.